I've been trying to communicate all my life. Sometimes I have been successful at it, and other times I have been an abysmal failure. When effective communication skills became imperative in my work, that was when I started to seriously study it. Over the last 10 years, I've worked for Leroy Imes here at the Glen. I've worked as employment manager in a high-tech electronics company. I've worked as a marketing consultant, and now I am a headhunter with a national search firm. In fact, I'd like to introduce you to my boss. Marge Goss is here in a lovely orchid dress. She's joined us today to see what this is all about and at my invitation. Marge herself is a master communicator. I would like you please to communicate to your own level of comfort. This workshop is structured to be highly participative. If you find yourself in an uncomfortable situation or role, please declare this and change it so that you are once again comfortable. The workshop is not designed to produce stress, but understanding. Right now, some of you are at a place where this will turn on a light bulb for you, some of the things that we'll be discussing. Some of the things that we will be discussing will have very little relevance. So pick and choose those things which will be helpful to you. Disregard those things which will not. The first thing I would like to do is to hear from you what you would hope to gain from our time together. I'd like to do this so that we can set realistic expectations. Some things that you will be wanting to know about, unfortunately, are not covered in the scope of the workshop. Other things I certainly hope will be. So let me hear from you. What are some of the things that you have come today wanting to hear about, wanting to know about, wanting to hear discussed? Anybody? How to arrive at a meeting of the minds? Okay. Someone else? I'm going to put heart here, too. What would you like to gain from our time together? Yes. Extemporaneous speaking? That, unfortunately, is not covered today. There will be elements, though, Linda, that you will be able to apply. But this is not designed for public communication, public presentation, more interpersonal, people to people. And what you might be able to do in a setting like that is think of communicating to one person in the congregation. So there will be elements, but this formally is outside the parameters. Somebody else? Yes.
When you're talking to someone, how to realize that you're not communicating?
How to know when you're not communicating? We will talk about that lots. Actually, we know when we're not getting through. It's what to do about it.
Right.
Yes. How to get through to another person. Would that be an accurate statement of? Okay. Someone else? Yes. Okay, then we're talking recognizing personality types and how to effectively communicate with personalities that are not easy, naturally easy for you to talk to. We will cover that. Someone else? Not directly. I had to cut material, and that was one area that went. Someone else? Jenna.
My problem is even preaching doesn't do very well.
I understand what you're saying. I identify with what you're saying. Then what you would be wanting to gain is how to communicate non-judgmentally? We will cover that. We will not cover that in a frontal way. But in fact, everything that we discuss today will be geared toward non-judgmental. Anybody else? Oh, yes. How to keep control of a conversation. How to recognize where the control is. Yes, we will cover that. This gives us a lot to work on this morning, and we have a lot to do. Let me ask you another question, and that is, in your thinking, what is communication? Never mind Webster, never mind people like that. To you, what is communication? When you feel like you have really communicated with somebody, how does it feel? What has happened? Yes. Communication is when the other person understands. Is okay. Don't raise your hands and wait for me to call on you. It slows us down. Just speak up. Lynn, could you repeat that again? Someone else? Communication is all of those things. In fact, we could say that communication is creating meaning between two or more people. That encompasses everything that we have said up here. When two or more people understand, then communication has occurred. It sounds simple, doesn't it? So simple. But why do we communicate? Why do we try to communicate? Why do we continuously try to communicate? Well, for several reasons, I think. One reason that we try to communicate is for understanding or to be understood. That goes along with the when I understand, being on the same wavelength. I communicate for pleasure because it feels so good when I understand what you really are thinking, what you're saying, and it feels so good to me when I am convinced that you understand what I am really thinking and feeling. The flip side of that is the frustration when I try and I try and I try and you still don't understand what I'm saying. When the words may be the same, but boy, that's all that's the same. So it feels good when communication has been effective. Also to influence others. To have you come around to my way of thinking. or to have you understand why I feel the way I do, why I think the way I do. I try to communicate so that my relationships can be improved. Those with the people who are closest to me, my friends, my family, those whose opinions and whose love is important to me. Sometimes those are the most difficult people to communicate with because we are so close, because we've developed patterns of communication and habits and behaviors that seem to negate an effective communication. We've developed bad habits and styles. Also, I try to communicate to produce action. I want you to do something. If you're my child, I do this a lot, an awfully lot. I communicate to you because I want you to do or not to do these various things. How do we know when communication has been successful? Well, it's very simple. And we have it right up here. Communication is successful when the other person understands what I have said. And in fact, when the other person can give back to me the same message that I have sent to them, when it has made the circle, the round trip, and is still intact. You know that party game, telephone, party line, where you start out and you whisper something and then you pass it on? And what a mess. What a mess. Well, successful communication is when it comes all around the circle and is the same as what I started with. We test whether our communication has been successful or not through feedback and by confirming. Do you understand? Does this make sense to you? How does this sound to you? Tell me what I've said. We say that to our children often. Now, say back to me, tell me now what I just asked you to do. And we know when we get back the same words that there's a better chance that what we have wanted will happen. Having said all this, how do we actually communicate? What do we do to actually, really, now this is serious, we're going to communicate. How do we communicate? Several ways. We communicate verbally, and we communicate nonverbally. We are better communicators nonverbally than we are verbally. Your actions speak louder than your words. I can't hear you because your body language is screaming at me. The inconsistencies. So the nonverbal is very, very, very important. We're going to be doing some exercises with that in a little bit. We communicate intentionally, and we communicate unintentionally. In fact, I have a theory, and so far it has not been disproven, and that is that you cannot not communicate. Hi, hon. How's your day? Fine. What'd you do today? Nothing. Is anything wrong? No. Now, I ask you, is that communication? You bet it's communication. I am saying, don't talk to me. I'm in a rotten mood. I also may be saying, please talk to me. I want you to ask me what's the matter. I am communicating, even though what I am saying is not consistent with what I am really saying. Another thing that we will be talking about later is how we process communication. And the only way we have to process communication is through our five senses. Through seeing how you behave nonverbally, through hearing what you say, and then through the other kinesthetic senses of, it feels to me like what you're really wanting to say is this or that or the other thing. Or when I put my hand on your shoulder and you stiffen, that is strong communication. So we process communication through our five senses. Becoming more effective in our communication involves a variety of things. It involves understanding the process. Just how does communication work? There are people who spend their lives studying this and making theories about it, testing those theories. It involves understanding the impediments to communication. What gets in the way What gets in the way of the meeting of a heart and mind? Becoming more effective communicators involves understanding what helps the communication process. And unfortunately, it also involves working at it. Today, I want to highlight three elements of communication. I want to talk about sending, I want to talk about processing, and I want to talk about receiving.
R-E-C-E-I-V.
Under sending, we will talk about verbal, nonverbal. We will also talk about congruency. In the area of processing communication, we will talk about perception and imagery. And in receiving communication, we will talk about confirming messages and people, and disconfirming. If we had time, listening would come under the receiving area as well, but that is not something we can spend time on today. Verbal communication is generally what we think of first, when we think of communicating. There are five areas of verbal communication that I'll mention. The first is volume. In order to communicate verbally, you have to speak so that people can hear. Now, here's an interesting statistic. This is not a statistic, this is a fact. It is said that Americans speak louder than the English, louder than Southeast Asians, and louder than Japanese, but not as loud as Arabs, or Spaniards, or South Asian Indians, or Russians. How does that sound? Is that consistent with what your experience has been? Volume is also influenced by childhood models and culture. Families where it is not permitted for people to scream and shout, generally people don't do that and react negatively if they are in a situation like that. Other families, they didn't put Italians on here. I think Italians talk louder than your normal run-of-the-mill American. With a lot of gestures, too. You know, they've got the verbal and the nonverbal. Another element to nonverbal Wait a minute. Nonverbal. This is wrong. This is verbal communication. Yes. Another element to verbal communication is rate. The average speaking rate is 125 to 150 words a minute. That seems awfully fast, but we tend to talk faster than we need to, although not as fast as people can listen. Did you know that the rate of speech is an excellent and a very stable indicator of emotion? That the faster a person talks, now this is faster than their normal rate. Some people just talk faster than others. And there may be some cultural input to that as well. Speaking faster would indicate fear or anger. The adrenaline is flowing. Speaking more slowly could indicate grief or depression, and I think that we can see that very, very easily. Another element to verbal communication is fluency and how we use pauses or fillers, fillers being ah, those sorts of things, when we never put a period to the end of our sentences. Another element of verbal communication is pitch. The optimum pitch is about one-third above the lowest pitch you can speak. So if you can really talk down here, then about, and you can really talk up here, then a third, you know, in the bottom third would be the most pleasant speaking voice for you. Pitch also affects the listener's attitude about the speaker. And this goes right into quality. Unpleasant qualities are the ones that stick out, such as hypernasality, whining. Boy, when I hear that, it sets my teeth on edge. And I don't really listen to what the person is saying because it's that whining that just grinds over me. Another is pitch. No, I said that. Another is denasality, stuffy head when you've got a cold. That affects the quality. Hoarseness or perpetual laryngitis. For Lauren Bacall, it's become a trademark. A strident quality or piercing is a very unpleasant quality. In fact, I think that that Solomon talked about that. I think a nagging woman probably has all of these qualities of unpleasantness in her voice. Breathiness or huskiness is another quality that sometimes can be distracting. Verbal communication is really the smaller portion of communication. Nonverbal communication makes up 70% of all of our communication. Watching what the person is doing while they are talking, feeling the vibes while they are talking. And in fact, if verbal and nonverbal signals are inconsistent, the message that will come through is the nonverbal. It is predictable, it is consistent, you can count on it. That makes it hard to be hypocritical convincingly. Nonverbal messages do one of three things. They either replace the verbal message, or they reinforce the verbal message, or they contradict it. The goal is to be 100% effective in communication so that when nonverbal communication reinforces the verbal, you've got a whole lot better chance of being misunderstood, of being understood. Did you know that there are nonverbal languages, in fact? Nonverbal languages include sign language. These are gestures that would replace words or numbers or punctuation. A lot of times we use gestures to replace exclamation points. Kids use gestures very well. In fact, well, in a cross-cultural setting, we tend to resort to sign language. You can park a car with sign language. They do it all the time. You can back a trailer with sign language. Action language. Action language is all other body movement. And it's actually the principal way that we express emotion. What we do with our hands, how we stand, how we sit, what we do with our face while we're talking or listening. That's action language. And the third nonverbal language is object language. This is a display of material things, jewelry, clothes. Bizarre dressing is one very loud type of object language. Unusual jewelry, lack of jewelry, the things that we surround ourselves with also speaks nonverbally. We talked a little bit now about verbal and nonverbal communication. And I think as we have been talking a little bit about it, you've been thinking, yes, I know a person who says one thing, but really I don't believe what she's saying. She doesn't appear to be sincere because there are inconsistencies. I would like to demonstrate this, but in order to do it, I need two volunteers. I will ask you to assume a role, and I have instructions for you of what I would like you to do. Could I have two volunteers? People who are secure, feeling secure in themselves. This is not the only exercise we're going to do. Others will have an opportunity to participate. So I need two volunteers. Okay. Rosemary. Rosemarie? Rosemarie. I need somebody to work along with Rosemarie. Okay. It's Sandy. Rosemarie, I'd like you to be volunteer number one, and these are your instructions. And Sandy, I'd like you to be volunteer number two, and these are your instructions. So I'll give you just a second to look at it. And then I'm going to sit down or stand over here. And let me tell the group that what we're doing is demonstrating verbal and nonverbal messages. Now the setting, let me set the setting for you, will be a mildly social conversation between two people who don't know each other very well. The subjects of the conversation may include travel to the conference, say, may include why you were motivated to attend the conference, might include summer plans, vacation plans, your work, your family, current interests, books, music, travel, social concerns, sports, anything. But it will be between people who don't know each other real well yet. So are you all ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, you can keep that.
Hi.
A little louder. Let me cut it here. Thank you. Thank you. What did you see happening here? What sort of communication were you seeing? Were people on the same wavelength? Were they talking together? Who seemed more distant? Sandy. Why did she seem more distant?
She crossed her arms and kind of stepped away.
Mm-hmm. What about her verbal? How did that seem to you?
Uneasy.
Uneasy? How... That's an interesting observation that you make. That's good. What about some of the others? What did you see?
The first one didn't look for the leader.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary seemed to take the lead in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Sandy was not as negative as she could have been. Is that what you're saying?
I think she gave some impressions that she had some areas she'd like to explore, have somebody explore with her. And she was drawing her out with it than Delmore.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good.
That's a good point. Oh, and one person can draw one person out at the same time.
That's true. That's true. Only one person can draw a person out at once. You can't both be drawing each other out at the same simultaneously, but it can go back and forth very quickly. I'd like to have two more volunteers to run through this again. Thank you. This time I would like you to really exaggerate the role that you have to play. And you're Nancy. I'll ask you to assume this role. I need somebody to play with Nancy. Okay. Thank you. I'll let you look at that for a minute. Sometimes it's hard to set aside your normal, nice, pleasant, eager to please and eager to communicate self. I would like for you all to try to not let that influence for the sake of communication and the sake of the exercise what we need to demonstrate right now. So take a couple of minutes and follow your instructions.
Is one of us supposed to initiate this?
Let me break. Thank you. Thank you very much. Did you find it uncomfortable being nasty, Nancy? You would have to say yes, wouldn't you? Did you pass these down your side, Edna? What's coming around to you now is what is considered to be a warm behavior and what is considered to be a cold behavior. Remembering the two roles that we saw played up here, read down through this. A warm behavior, for instance, looks into the eyes of the other person. A cold behavior would give a cold stare, fish stare, or even not even look at the person. A warm behavior would be touching the hand or the elbow or your shoulder. A cold behavior would be showing absolute disinterest. I could not be bothered less with what you have to say. Giving a fake yawn. So stereotypical. People who smile frequently may be very warm and very pleasant, maybe nervous as well. Sometimes we smile and grin and laugh even because we're uncomfortable. A warm behavior works her eyes from his head to his toes. I see it more in the reverse of he working his eyes from her head to her toes. That's considered a warm behavior. At that time, she can either frown, move away from him, give a fake yawn, sneer, or give him a cold stare. Sitting directly in front of people, face to face, is a very warm thing to do. Sitting side to side sometimes implies companionship as well. And you all know the thing of crossing the leg. If you cross it toward the person, that's supposed to mean you're feeling more kindly toward them. If you cross it away from them, then you're not feeling so kindly toward them. Sometimes, though, it just means you need to stretch. Using expressive hand gestures is considered to be a warm behavior. I think that's true. When we're feeling more comfortable, we tend to be looser. Also, feeling comfortable and feeling warm, you occupy more space. Drape your arm over the chair next to you or stand bigger. When we're not feeling comfortable, we try to occupy as small a space as we can. We really do. People in interview situations sit very, very compactly. So that would be one thing to observe. If when you're talking with somebody, they're tending to shrink back, either physically or emotionally, watch for some of those things. People who are uncomfortable will play with themselves, their hands, a ring, their ear, their collar, the hem of the skirt. And while you may be thinking that you're just being very warm and gushing, it may be too much. It may be too much for them at that time. It may be making them uncomfortable, so they're exhibiting cold behaviors. So knowing, and we know this, I think intuitively we know this. Sometimes having it captured on paper and a list helps us to recall it so that we can utilize what we need to do more effectively. One of the things which we would have seen with the two sets of volunteers that we had was how nonverbal language is communicated. We communicate nonverbally by physical proximity. If I'm feeling comfortable, I tend to stand closer and be closer to the person I'm talking to or communicating with. And conversely, the less comfortable I feel, the more discomfort I feel, the more I back away. This would be an interesting study to see where people would sit, say, in church. And there are studies made in a room set up like this or in a classroom where people sit. Whether closer to the front, whether the right, the left, all of those things. But physical proximity indicates how comfortable we are or are not. Another thing that communicates is facial expression, obviously. I mean, this almost goes without saying. The interesting thing is that facial expression is, in my thinking, cross-cultural. The same look of surprise, of dismay, of shock, of horror, of, come on, I don't believe you. those things are relatively cross-cultural. Jen is shaking her head. World traveler, good. I'm glad to see it's confirmed. Eye contact is another nonverbal, is another way that we communicate nonverbally. In the U.S., it's okay to look at somebody who you're meeting on the street until if they get to be about 8 feet from you. And then you drop your eyes, you look away, but you dim your lights. And this is true. That is the way that we are. Did you know that it is very, very, very difficult to lie with your eyes? That by studying a person's eyes, you can usually tell really what they're thinking. That's what they do at customs. Rather than looking at your suitcase, they're really looking at you. In fact, we have less conscious control over the muscles in the upper part of our face than we do the muscles in the lower part of our face. So while we can hold our mouths in a certain way to belie our feelings, it is very, very, very difficult to do this with our eyes. Eyes communicate spontaneously. Speakers who use more eye contact are considered more earnest and believable. This would help you when you're called on to speak extemporaneously. Just look at somebody. Speak with conviction, and that'll do it. Also, eye contact is a sign of affection and interest. If I really have an interest in what you're saying, I'll look at you. And if I don't, I'm looking somewhere else. This works person to person, one to one, as well as speaker to group. They've done experiments in classroom settings where they have instructed the students not to look at the teacher, not to look at the instructor. And it drives the instructor batty, absolutely batty, because without feedback, without eye contact, you just go wild. Now, I'm glad you didn't decide to try that. Body movement. While facial and eye cues indicate what emotion is being experienced, body movement indicates the intensity of that emotion. So you get your primary clues and cues from the face, and then you confirm that with the rest of the body movement. Hand gestures are second in importance only to facial cues. In fact, sometimes, as we've already talked about, hand gestures substitute for verbal communication. The only difficulty with hand gestures is that sometimes they are culturally oriented. They usually are culturally oriented and sometimes a little bewildering. What means one thing and what's okay to do in one culture, you have been just insulted somebody if you do that in another culture. How to overcome that, I don't know. Just know. Or just look with your hands at your side. Physical appearance. Our physical appearance creates the first impression and also the longest lasting impression. People who are overly conscious of their physical appearance may suggest that they are overly anxious or overly eager to please. But it may be something as simple as holding to traditional values. People who are relatively unconscious of their physical appearance may suggest a more independent or aggressive nature. The artist who comes to a black tie affair wearing jeans and a t-shirt would fit this category. Are there other things that you can think of other ways that we communicate nonverbally? Does anything else come to mind? That's a good observation. I think that's true. Did you all hear? Could you say it again?
When I see a woman in a dress rather than
I think that's true. Sometimes it may be culture, it may be the environment, it may be what's accepted. Let's talk just a minute about the need for congruence. Congruence is keeping verbal and nonverbal together in line so as not to give conflicting messages. It is essential that you or whoever it is behave in a congruent manner in order to establish rapport. This is whether between two people or whether between a leader and group. When we can learn to recognize incongruity in people, and I think we know how to do this, but when we recognize that that is what it is, that the verbal and the nonverbal are not matching up, then that is our cue and our clue to do several things, to probe deeper, to see what it is, what is causing the incongruity, and am I making the person uncomfortable? Are they lying to me? Are we getting into an area where they are uncomfortable? Do they not really want to talk to me about this? Is this not a good time? Am I on the phone and the doorbell just rang? Is the coffee boiling over? To figure out what is causing the incongruity and then to deal with it. We can also choose to match another person's nonverbal style in order to develop rapport. They teach this to salespeople. To match the verbal behavior, the nonverbal behavior of the person I want to sell to. If you're sitting with your arms crossed, your wrist crossed, and your knee over the other, if I do that, then we're together. If you're leaning up on the desk and I'm sitting back like this, we're not together. If at dinner in a restaurant, if I'm eating very fast and you're eating very slow and I am wanting to impress you or to come closer to you, I better slow down. Just to match the style of the other person helps greatly in communication. It's something that almost you feel awkward doing, and I'm not going to ask any of us to do it just now, but it feels awkward at first when somebody is sitting like this, and I'm sitting like this because I want them to listen to me. And they keep going like this, and I keep going like this more. It's time to stop and say, you know, tell myself, okay, this is not working. Back up, take a breath, and match the other person. It works. Also, when you see people, when you're watching people who are talking to each other or not talking to each other, just to watch them, how they are in rapport, in congruence, or they're not. Have any of you had experiences with this? So you believe what I'm saying? Good. Good. This concludes the receiving side. We talked about congruence. We talked about nonverbal. And we talked about verbal messages. Now we're ready to move on to processing information. Processing information is just what it sounds like. In fact, we process communication and sensation through two different filters. One is through our minds, the psychological filter, which we'll deal with when we talk about perception. The other is the physiological filter through which we pass stimuli, and that is, we'll talk about that when we talk about imagery. This is mind. This is body. Perceptual filters come from a variety of sources. One is our past experiences. We process information and sensation and stimuli through a filter of our prior experiences. We also process information through our cultural background. And we process information through the context of the situation. Having said that, let me ask you to take a look at this and tell me what you see. What do you see? Let's start with this. What colors do you see? Okay. What does it look like? Looks like a vase of flowers. It looks like two faces. Does it look like anything else? Yes. Uh-huh. Two people looking at each other? Okay. Anything else? Who of you saw the vase first? Who of you saw the faces first? Neither is good or bad. I'm just curious. What do you see now? A what? A woman. Can you describe her?
She's looking away and back here and there's something over there.
Okay. About what age would she be?
In
her 20s. Okay. What else do you see? Okay. Does everybody see the old hag? Could you come and show us how she is up here? Does everybody see the young woman? No. I'm the last one to throw stones, believe me. When I see something, I see it, and when I don't, I don't. Kind of a Gibson girl, the young woman. She's got a puffy hairdo. This is her ear. She's looking kind of over in this direction, a nice jawline. This doesn't have anything to do with the young woman.
Well, could be a necklace.
Could be a necklace. Like I said. A very low neckline. Lucky she's not facing us. Does everybody see the old woman? What do you think this is saying about perception? The picture is the same. The eye of the beholder. There's one more. What do you see here? Someone drowning? What sort of a person drowning? Uh-huh. Do you see anything else? Sleeping Beauty.
She's sunbathing.
Do you see her lover?
Yes.
Does she change?
Her?
No.
Okay.
No. Not that I have found. Well, that's very interesting. But that's another seminar. What this demonstrates is that perception is in the eye of the beholder. Perception is the active process of selecting, organizing, and interpreting the stimuli that we experience. Perception is the active process of selecting, organizing, and interpreting the stimuli that we experience. There are six elements of perception. The first is your own personal theory of personality. This is what goes with what. Shifty eyes go with dishonesty, right? Of course they do. I have decided in my own amateur psychologist way that that is so. So one of my tenets, my theory of personality, is that squinty eyes go with dishonesty. I have just decided. It is totally irrational, and that doesn't matter. Another element of perception is first impressions. These are most decisive in forming our thoughts of others, and they are very difficult to change. We talked about physical appearance creating a long-lasting impression. Obviously, first impressions usually go on physical appearance. They go together. Physical attractiveness is another element in the whole area of perception. It is a fact, like it or not, that physically attractive people are considered to be, I'll write these down, more sociable, more popular, sexy, are considered to be successful, persuasive, and happy. Irrational is not necessarily so. But when we see somebody who is physically attractive, we are more inclined to think of them as having these other characteristics. But while physical beauty is the most powerful influence early in a relationship, its effect diminishes rapidly as the relationship develops and as more information is acquired. It does not last, and yet it is a strong, undeniable factor. Stereotypes is another element of perception. Listen to this. The story is told of an elderly club member who was attending a distinguished public dinner in London. He was disconcerted to find himself seated next to a silent Chinese. Wanting to be courteous, however, he leaned toward him and tentatively asked this. Like you, soupy? The Chinese looked at him briefly, nodded, but said nothing, and the conversation lapsed. However, it appeared that the Chinese was a foreign guest of some note, for as coffee was served, he was called upon to say a few words. He rose, bowed, and made a 15-minute speech in impeccable English about the sociological significance of the European common market. Amid polite applause, he then sat down, turned to his abashed English neighbor, and after the briefest of pauses, asked softly, "Likey's peachy?" What had happened? The Englishman had made a generalization and stereotyped the Chinese person, and it did not fit. Another part besides culture that goes into our stereotypes is race. We stereotype about races. And it is true, it is not because you are racist, that it is easier to distinguish the individuals in your own race than it is in others. Physical attributes, the length or color of a person's hair, the height, that's a stereotype. Our own emotional state leads to various perceptions. If I am feeling self-confident, then I tend to perceive everybody else as being okay. If I am feeling down, if I am feeling rotten, if I'm feeling depressed, then I tend to think of everybody else as being on top of the world, and I'm not, poor me, I'm going to go back to bed and pull the covers over my head. Also, the context of the circumstance. The next area that we're talking about now is imagery, the second part in processing communication. Imagery in communication is about how a person retrieves information from his or her own memory bank and then presents it to others. Imagery is how I pull out information and how I present it to others. Imagery, we use imagery to help a person recall information as well as to give information. And by listening to somebody else, we can understand how she processes information. And by knowing this, then we can communicate more effectively with her or with him. We can use words that are more easily assimilated and internalized. By watching a person's eye movements, we can get a fairly accurate idea of how a person processes and integrates information. Everybody uses three different types of imagery for representing information. And we're going to do an exercise on this in a minute. We're all going to do an exercise on this in a minute. We use visual imagery, words like I see, it looks like, it might look like. We use auditory imagery, phrases like, it sounds like, well, you know, what I hear you saying really is this or that. We use kinesthetic imagery, and this is centering around movement or touch or feelings. You know, I'm really in touch with the situation. You know, I really understand how you feel. That's a kinesthetic type of imagery. By knowing how people assimilate information, listen to yourself for a little while. How do you talk? Do you hear yourself saying phrases like, you know, that really makes sense? That's kinesthetic. If you hear yourself saying, you know, I see what you're saying, that's visual. You're processing information visually. If you're the type of person who forever sleeps through a symphony but loves ballet, you may be more visually oriented. If you are the sort of person who likes to go and sit in the park, likes to take a walk in the rain, you may be more kinesthetically oriented. If you hear yourself saying things like, you know, that really sounds good, let's run with it, that's auditorily. Is it making sense, those three different areas, visually, auditorially, and kinesthetically. Now, what this transparency is showing is that when I am thinking and trying to recall, I actually look in different directions. Now, this is the person looking at you. And if she is looking up and to the right, what she is doing is trying to remember, you know, I can see the word on the page, but I can't remember it, and it's on the test. I'm looking up here trying to remember where it was. If I am looking up, in fact, looking up in either direction is more visual, trying to see where it was. If I am looking over to my left and I'm talking and I'm looking either eye level or down, from here down, I'm trying to remember how it felt or how it seemed. If I am looking to my right and either straight ahead or down, I'm trying to remember how it sounded. This is getting a little bit complicated, and I will hand out to you a hard copy of this, because you need to be, if you're interested in it, be able to kind of look at it and study it and internalize it, so that when you're talking to somebody, like I would be talking to Marge, if she's looking up over here, then I'm saying she's trying to remember what it looked like. And she's trying to remember what it looked like. If she's looking up over here, she's thinking visually. Ha ha! She's a visual person. Talk to her in words that say, do you see what I mean? Huh? See what I mean? Things like that. I want to give all of you a copy of this, and I want you to divide yourself into groups of three, and I want us to practice this. So, very quickly, because our time is ticking, divide yourself into groups of three. Doesn't matter whether you are with somebody you know or you don't know. It won't hinder or help. And we're going to do a little practice.
Read No.
Thank you.
take only about two more minutes. I don't know that it is international, but I don't know that it's not. I don't know. Yeah. I haven't tried it with them. That would be interesting to see if it's cultural or if it's inborn. I would tend to think it's inborn. I would think. Yeah. You should be finishing up. You should be moving back to the group now. Yeah, fixing the chairs back. All right,
here we go.
Friends. Ooh, look at all that nonverbal.
I like that nonverbal.
Yeah.
I like
the nonverbal. Uh-huh. They're a lot nicer, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear reports back from a couple of the groups, how you found this exercise to be. Uh-huh. Let's hear from a couple of you. How did you find this? That's your interesting. Betty did a good job. Did you find it true that some questions were easier to answer than others? That some, the answers were right there? Which ones seemed to be easier? Thelma? Which hand you pick up the phone. Who found that to be a very easy question? Most people, and five raised their hands. Okay. Which ear do you use? Does that have to do with the hand as well? You used your left? That is not a, that is a very good question, and it is very confusing. The person, this woman on the chart, on the picture that you have, when she is looking up and to her right, yes, visual thinking is up and to her right. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. If you're looking at somebody, then you've got to flip it. When I am looking up and to my right, I'm trying to think visually. Does that match what that says? Yes. You have to flip it. Like when you set the table from the other side. You have to flip it. Was this helpful to you? You looked around a lot. Were you conscious of where you were looking?
Sometimes.
That may have been confusing. If I had not given you the handout until afterward, we wouldn't have been as aware of that.
Susan,
yes.
There seems to be a very close correlation between visual thinking and visual memory. Does that all depend on which side you look, to what you're doing? What's the difference? Because with our person here, and she looked to her left, I think it was her left, and I'm in her right, but she went through the process of really doing both.
Mm-hmm.
She went through the process of thinking and remembering.
We did both. We do both.
Yes, but we don't change directions in the way we look. We go through the same process, but we don't change directions.
This would be worth testing further, because in this instance, it was awkward. And we were more aware of what we were doing with our eyes, and that could easily have thrown it off. I would test that further to see what holds consistent. Because we're actually talking about the difference between remembering and thinking. And in thinking, there is a lot of recalling, especially the older we get. So that's a hard question to answer, and I don't know that there's a clear yes-no answer.
Student, I could see when she was thinking. And then
you could probably smell when she was thinking. you could smell when you were thinking. It was, working so hard. Karen.
It was very obvious.
Now that's interesting. Mm-hmm. You might want to practice this a little at lunchtime. Karen. That would have clarified it, probably. Yes, it probably would have. Yes. Oh, I thought there was something. Yes.
One thing that I noticed when I asked her the first question about the windows in her house, we had eye contact. She continued to look at me, but I could tell she was not seeing me.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't that? Did some of the others of you experience that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Are some of the visual and the other easier for certain people than others?
Yes, we're all inclined to one primary way of processing information or the other. One comes more easily to us. So that is true. Yes. You're thinking real hard. You know, I think that may be an acquired and a learned habit, because we know it's good to talk face-to-face, eye-to-eye with people. And I think sometimes we train ourselves to do that, because we want to be open, we want to be warm, we know it's a good thing to do. But in your most intimate relationships, you don't tend to look face-to-face, eye-to-eye. You're so comfortable that is not a necessary behavior. And you don't cut your finger on the tomato. Good. Good. We need to cover one last area very quickly, and that is in receiving messages. Again, there are three elements in the whole thing of receiving messages. The first is the message content. What does it say? What is it about? It includes verbal, it includes nonverbal, and it includes congruency. So the message that I send has all three of those elements: verbal, nonverbal, and the fact of being congruent or not. That's the message content. The second element is the relationship between the communicators. This is the processing segment, which includes perception and imagery. what I think about you, how I feel about you, how comfortable I am with you, how I perceive you to be, whether I think you're going to scream at me or whether you're going to try to convince me of something I don't want or don't want to buy. I already have 6 sets of encyclopedias because I couldn't communicate well with the person and tell them no. Also has to do with the response of the recipient, and that's what we're going to be talking about. This is the area that either ties the bow on the package and successfully completes the communication or causes the effort to unravel and remain incomplete. There are 2 types of responses. The first is a confirming response. A confirming response will cause the other person, the sender, to value him or herself more. A confirming response will cause the other person to value herself more. Now, there are different types of confirming responses. One is a direct acknowledgement, usually with a direct verbal response. Hi, how are you doing? Fine, thank you. A direct verbal response, direct acknowledgement. Also, positive feeling. Conveys your own positive feeling about what the sender has just said. How are you today? Fine, thank you. And I smile. I'm fine, thanks. How are you? That conveys a positive feeling. A clarifying response. Obviously, just that. It asks the sender to clarify or expand on the content of the message. How are you feeling? What do you mean? How am I feeling, physically or emotionally? That would be a clarifying response. An agreeing response affirms what the sender said. It's a beautiful day out, isn't it? Yes, it is just gorgeous. That's an agreeing response. And a supportive response offers comfort, understanding, reassurance. I understand how you feel. I felt that way too. So these are all the different sorts of things that I can do when you talk to me to say, yes, I understand. Yes, I value you. Yes, what you're saying is important. That is the message that I communicate when I do any one or all of these. The flip side is damaging. A disconfirming response will cause the other person to value herself less. In fact, a disconfirming response both rejects the speaker and what she has to say. A disconfirming response is one of the most damaging interpersonal responses possible. In fact, it may eventually lead the sender to question his or her own identity. Saying, you are not important, is not too far from saying, you do not exist. For me, you cease to be an entity. We can do great, great damage to people by sending them disconfirming responses.